13. Considering the lunch at 84 Gibson Street, Leongatha, on the 29th of July 2023 has become the most talked about meal since the Last Supper, surprisingly little is known about what was actually said at it. The surviving participants didn't tell us much at all, at least not that we heard at the trial. Before lunch, as Aaron was plating up, Gail told Aaron that Simon's youngest brother, Nathan, and his wife, Meryn, had had their baby. So that was good news. But after everyone had taken their seats and Ian had said grace, what was the conversation? "Oh, we talked about what we'd been up to, what had been happening in the family," said Aaron. "Probably a bit of politics and current affairs." I didn't doubt that. The public debate on the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice to Parliament referendum would soon reach its peak, but still, there were few other details. "And we talked about what the kids were doing. They all asked a lot of questions about the kids, or at least Heather and Gail did. At one point, I remember Don talking about his brother who was battling throat cancer. I think it was Bobby." In Ian's evidence, all we heard about was some banter over the fact that the meal was too big for Gail and Don ate half of her beef Wellington as well as his own. There was talk about husbands helping their wives out by eating extra food, Ian told us. Heather mentioned we should have shared a beef Wellington because she thought the meal was a bit on the large side for her. Nonetheless, both she and Ian ate their whole servings. Ian couldn't remember how much Erin ate, but he did remember her eating. Erin said she ate about a third to a half of her Wellington, and on balance, I was happy to accept that was probably accurate. But while Erin ate, I wondered what was going through her mind. What was she really thinking while she was happily chatting away? I tried to imagine both possible Erins and wondered which one was real. At this stage, she was still Schrodinger's cat. Innocent Erin and guilty Erin were both possible. We just didn't know which one was sitting in front of us. Innocent Erin would have been quietly chuffed, I thought. Her meal was a hit, conversation was flowing, Heather had admired her garden and she was being embraced by the family. The day was looking like a success. Yay. It was harder to get inside the head of guilty Erin. Guilty Erin would have thermomixed and slow-cooked all the button mushrooms first thing that morning, then separated out a third of that mixture before taking her secret Tupperware container of dehydrated death cap mushrooms out of the pantry and then deliberately... No, wait. She wouldn't have risked any chance of getting death caps anywhere near the uncontaminated Wellingtons. So she would have wrapped those first. She had to make sure those Wellingtons were always separate, on a different oven rack or something, whatever. After that, she would have added death cap mushrooms to the remaining mixture still in the pan and folded them in with an egg flip. But did she hesitate? Did she have any second thoughts? Or was she simply floating in a lake of dopamine? This family, I swear to fucking God. For the last several years, they had been slowly driving her up the wall, but now she was going to get rid of them forever, and they wouldn't even know what hit them. And then everyone at the table would have started eating, and they would have said all these nice things about how tasty it was. Yum, well done, Erin. And they would have had no idea what they were eating. Any regrets? If Erin was guilty, she hadn't hinted at any. And clearly she hadn't said or done anything over lunch to make anyone suspect anything. She'd just kept up a normal domestic conversation while she watched them all kill themselves. That was guilty, Erin. Imagine planning something like that. For months, carefully, step by step. Then watching it succeed flawlessly. Watching every single thing go exactly according to plan. Apart from Simon's absence, that was still annoying. Nonetheless, the sheer power she must have felt she had, like a Roman emperor or the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland off with their heads. It must have been exhilarating. In fact, it was almost unbelievable. It was so hard to imagine that guilty Erin could be a real person. If I couldn't imagine being in that situation myself, it was very difficult to think she could truly be real. But maybe it would all come together as we heard more. I just had to be patient and wait while the rest of the evidence was put in front of us. The rest of the evidence began with the final conversation between the five lunch guests. After the beef Wellingtons, Erin tabled a cake that Gail had brought and a fruit platter that Heather had brought. Not much was eaten from either. Everyone was full from the main course. Jane Warren, for the prosecution, took Ian Wilkinson chronologically through the day when he gave his evidence, teasing out what had happened, what he'd seen, and any memory he still had regarding who had said what. When they reached the end of the meal, Jane asked him, was there any further conversation? Yes, there was. What was that about? Asked Jane. After the lunch, Erin announced that she had cancer, said Ian. She said that she was very concerned because she believed it was very serious, life-threatening. She was anxious about telling the kids. She was asking our advice about that. Should I tell the kids or not tell the kids about this threat to my life? In that moment, I thought, this is the reason we've been invited to lunch to... Sorry, interrupted Jane. I'll just stop you there. You said that she announced that she had cancer? Yes. Did she say what type of cancer? She did. I didn't quite catch what she said, but I thought it was some sort of ovarian or cervical cancer, something like that. Was there any diagnostic test that she'd had that showed a spot on the scan that was a tumour? Jane continued. What scan? I thought. Who mentioned a scan? But anyway... I don't recall a lot of discussion about that, continued Ian. The conversation moved fairly quickly to the point of anxiety which Erin had expressed, which was, what do I do with the kids in this situation? Did you or any of the other guests provide advice? Yes. Don spoke first and said he thought it would be best to be honest with the kids, and then there was a bit of general conversation and that was what we all thought. How long did that conversation go for? It felt like it was fairly short, maybe 10 minutes. But in a moment of tension like that, maybe more time passes than you think. But I would say it was a relatively short conversation. Then Jack and his friend were arriving back at the house. They were being dropped off. We could see out the window. So I realized we weren't going to be able to continue, but that we hadn't prayed about it. So I suggested that we pray. And I prayed a prayer, asking God's blessing on Erin, that she would get the treatment that she needed, that the kids would be okay, that she'd have wisdom in how she told the kids. And then the prayer concluded as the boys arrived in the room. I have to admit that it did cross my mind that if Erin was guilty, this would have been a supreme moment of bliss for her. Having killed them, she'd then managed to get them to pray for her. What an exquisite twist. You want to define triumph? Nothing could have been closer. Anyway, after the prayer, the group broke up. Jack came over and talked to Don and Ian about learning to be a pilot. He was due to have a flying lesson the following day. Ian couldn't remember what the women were doing, but it was only a couple of minutes later that he realised they had to leave. Ian had to get back to Corranborough for a 3 p.m. meeting with his church's treasurer and secretary, so he and Heather and Don and Gail quickly said their goodbyes and left. Ian Wilkinson had been a very reliable witness. He seemed honest and straightforward about things he didn't remember clearly and direct and confident about things he did. It was therefore hardly surprising that when it came time for Ian's cross-examination, Colin Mandy figured anything he could do to shake our confidence in Ian's reliability was fair game. That was Colin's job. There were a lot of questions from him about where Ian saw Erin plate up the Wellingtons and from what tray each of them came. But by and large, I don't think that really got anywhere. It didn't play into any final decision on Erin's guilt or innocence. Colin also grilled Ian on the plates, doing his best to shake that memory of the four grey plates and get Ian to concede that maybe he was wrong. He kept on suggesting to Ian that he must have been mistaken, that the Wellingtons were really on a mix of other plates, black, white, coloured and so on, and he only thought he saw four grey plates. But no, Ian held firm. He was politely and quietly adamant. There were four grey plates, and Erin kept her orangey-tan one. We only had his word on that, of course. If he was right, what had happened to those plates was a mystery. But he certainly believed he was right. That shone through. There were no second thoughts or weakening of that memory at all. Colin did, however, eventually find a chink. To us, it seemed that Ian had been quite direct on Erin's declaration of her health problem. After the lunch, Erin announced that she had cancer, he had said. But Colin was able to point out that in Ian's very first statement to police, back in September 2023, he had said, Erin announced that she had a suspected cancer. In unpacking that very slight difference, Ian elaborated. I think she was saying that she had cancer because she went on to talk about a diagnostic scan of some sort which showed a tumour. Okay, so that's where Jane got the scan from. It was in Ian's first statement. Guess I hadn't done my homework. We had been given all that stuff. Meanwhile, Colin was picking at the loose threads of memory. So when you said to the police that Erin announced that she had suspected cancer, was that true? Clearly what Colin wanted us to think was that, given how much time had passed since the fatal lunch, no one could safely say what was true. He was trying to muddy the waters. At length, Ian replied cautiously, I think she was saying she had cancer. I'm asking you a more specific question, Mr. Wilkinson. When you said to the police in your statement that you were careful to be complete about, that Erin announced that she had suspected cancer, that was the truth as far as you were concerned at the time, wasn't it? I think I was probably understating things at that point. So it wasn't the truth? Well, I believed that she was saying she had cancer, and you believe that that is what she was saying? You don't remember the words that she used directly or completely, but that was the impression that you had, I take it. In under 2 minutes, Colin had successfully made it look like Ian didn't really remember exactly what had been said at all. While I took the point he was making, Colin also underestimated the degree to which I resented a smartass using slick gotcha moments to undermine the credibility of a gentle, compassionate man who had come within a whisker of being killed by the events he was describing. Not a fair fight, really. I liked Colin, but he had to be careful. What he said had to strike me as being right, not just cleverer. But now that he had sown doubts about what had really been said in that conversation, the door was open for Erin. So it was right at the end of the meal, and I mentioned that I'd had a, maybe not scare is the right word, but I had an issue a year or two earlier where I thought I had ovarian cancer and had various scans about and related to that. Erin told us when she later took her place in the witness box. And then, I'm not proud of this, but I led them to believe that I might be needing some treatment in regards to that in the next few weeks or months. Much vaguer and much less alarmist. And can you remember what you said about that in any more detail? Not specifically, answered Erin. Well, of course you wouldn't if what you'd really said was what Ian remembered you saying. I do remember I referred to upcoming treatment, she continued, because primarily in my mind I was thinking I might need help with getting the kids to and from the bus or activities, and I might need to explain why I was going out to hospital for a day or two, so that was really the focus of what I was talking about. Did you mislead them? Asked Colin, who didn't want any of Erin's bad behaviour lying around for the prosecution to stab with a red-hot poker. I did. How did that conversation conclude? They all showed a lot of compassion about that, and then we saw Simon's car coming back with the kids, and so Ian said, why don't we pray for Erin? And so that's what we did. I asked you, did you mislead them? Did you lie to them? I did lie to them. And why didn't you tell them the truth about what you were intending? I was really embarrassed, answered Erin haltingly. I was ashamed of the fact that I didn't have control over my body or what I ate. I was ashamed of that and embarrassed. I didn't want to tell anybody. I'd been fighting a never-ending battle of low self-esteem most of my adult life, and the further inroads I made into being middle-aged, the less good I felt about myself, I suppose. Put on more weight. Could handle exercise less. Was it principally the weight issue? Continued Colin. Yeah, I mean, that was the bulk of it, yep. And did you have plans to address the weight issue? He asked, as if he didn't know. I did. And what were those plans? I was planning to have weight loss surgery. You know, is it gastric bypass? I was planning to do that. Okay, so let's pause there for a second. At the moment, we were hearing a story. It had emerged rather late in the day, but still, it could all be true. Maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't. Nothing specific was being said about what Erin's plans actually were, of course. That was one point. I make plans all the time and then don't do anything to make them happen. Also, Erin hadn't exactly struck me as someone suffering from low self-esteem. That said, I'm sure we all know insecure people who hide behind very confident personas. It could have all been true. So where did that leave us? To begin with, as far as the whole ovarian cancer business is concerned, the cancer diagnosis and treatment for cancer, whatever the details were, she did not have cancer. The police could and did prove that. And Erin had conceded that part of the story was a lie. Why say it then? This is where it got interesting. Nanette and her prosecution team started from the assumption that we were dealing with guilty Erin. They claimed that Erin had indeed said the hard version of the cancer story, as Ian had recounted, because she needed such an outrageous lie to persuade her guests to come to her lunch table. And this was further evidence of her guilt, because its untruth would have been uncovered in no time at all. She had no oncologist, and she wasn't starting treatment anywhere. Her whopper would have fallen apart in a few days or weeks after the lunch, and the damage it would have done to her reputation with the Patterson family would have been enormous. Unless the people who heard the lie were all dead. If they were all dead, it didn't matter how big her lie was, because they wouldn't be around to tell anyone. According to Nanette, therefore, the size of Erin's extraordinary lie could only be explained by assuming that Erin already knew none of them were going to live to repeat it. Colin Mandy, and Erin probably, knew that theory did have one thing going for it. The prosecution was right when they said that such an extraordinary lie would fall apart pretty quickly. That was patently obvious. But if Erin's softer version of her cancer lie was true, if she hadn't been quite so adamant that she definitely had cancer, but instead had just floated a vague possibility and let them believe it, then it fitted much better with the story of innocent Erin. In this version, she was a woman in an emotional crisis who had organised a family lunch as a cry for help, but, because of the depth of her shame, could not bring herself to confess her real worries and fears. These two narratives, and the two Erins, innocent Erin and guilty Erin, were starting to look very different, but equally believable. We had so much to untangle.